So today I'd like to discuss something with you that will probably sound completely random and disconnected from our modern society, but I assure you it's not. Back in 1942, physiologist Walter Buchanan coined the term voodoo death. Cannon was a longtime Rockefeller Foundation-connected chairman of the Department of Physiology at Harvard Medical School, and he published this paper which has been claimed that if it were to be submitted to a scientific journal today, it wouldn't make it beyond the review process, as it would likely be described and probably disdainfully as simply anecdotal and hypothetical, despite the fact that Cannon's research here helped form the basis of much of our modern understanding of the physiological response systems involved in linking emotions, such as fear, with illness. Cannon's also the guy who coined the term fight or flight, the physiological stress response that happens in your body when you perceive a threat to your survival. Now, I want to be clear here that we've studied multiple religions and the customs and beliefs of many native tribes, and I don't think the phenomenon of death by curse, which Cannon is referring to as, quote, voodoo death, is necessarily something that can be exclusively linked to voodoo as a religious practice. I think when the phrase voodoo death gets used, it comes off as some superstitious primitive thinking, and then the concepts behind it just get easily dismissed. And that's a mistake.
Up a new potential pandemic, a pandemic which they say will be known as Disease X. No.
This has to do with the power of our beliefs and how those beliefs can physically affect the systems in our body. So here's Cannon's paper from 1942, and he begins by talking about how there are reports of death by curse or fear all over the world. They're being reported in South America, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific Islands, as well as the Caribbean. This was first observed, at least, I guess, in the literature in 1587 by Soares de Souza, when he observed instances of death among the Tupinambas tribe, which were induced by fright when the men were condemned and sentenced by a so-called quote-unquote medicine man. Cannon writes, likewise, Varnhagen in 1875 remarks that generally among Brazilian tribes, the members, lacking their own personal knowledge, accept without question whatever is told to them. Thus, the chief or the medicine man gains the reputation of exercising supernatural powers. And by intimidation or terrifying prediction, he may cause death from fear. And he has a bunch of different instances and cases of this. I'm not going to list them all, but there was another story by a man called Leonard out of Africa in 1906, where a soldier thought himself to be bewitched and died steadily and by inches. No nourishment or medicines would have any effect to improving the man's condition. Basically, nothing was able to divert the soldier from the fate that he himself was certain that he would succumb to and considered to be inevitable. Leonard writes, I have seen others die in spite of every effort that was made to save them simply because they had made up their minds. And he specifies this point, not that they made up their minds to die, but that they made up their minds that being in the clutch of whatever malignant forces meant that they were bound to die.
So, Disease X is a term for a hypothetical illness, one that has not happened and is currently unknown.
So it was the belief in the authority of the medicine man or whoever told the person they were cursed. And it was what the medicine man said and the belief in what he said that led to the death. In other words, it's the person's mind and the belief and the fear associated with whatever that is that makes it as real as any tangible physical thing you can touch, hold, you know, taste, smell, etc. And he has a bunch of other reports in here from other Rockefeller Foundation doctors who are working in various areas around the world who have witnessed death by apparent fear. But there's also a case in here of a miraculous recovery that was noted by Dr. Lambert, who was working at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pacific Health Service, and told Cannon about a missionary helper named Rob who became afflicted after a medicine man pointed a cursed bone at him. And Rob just began to waste away. He became lethargic and weak. He started showing all kinds of symptoms of being seriously ill, despite there being no actual evidence of any disease. And so Dr. Lambert went and found the medicine man who pointed the bone at Rob and told him if he did not tell Rob that this wasn't real, they would cut off all the people of the tribe from any further aid from the mission. And the medicine man then agreed to visit Rob, told him it was all a joke and a mistake. And Dr. Lambert testified that the relief that Rob felt upon this news from the medicine man made him start to feel better immediately. And by later that evening, all of his strength returned. He was completely better. The curse was lifted. They rule out poison in these cases. They talk about how in most of these cases, there was testing done. Just no poisons were detected. Some of these groups, they felt like there weren't even any plants in the area where things were that would be able to be used in that way. Other doctors who wrote about these cases referred to them as malignant psychic influences, quote unquote, or they attributed it to something they referred to as malignant anxiety. And it works both ways. It isn't just curses and death, it's also cures. If the medicine man comes and does something and says, whatever this thing is I'm doing, it's going to cure you, it works just the same. That person becomes cured. Cannon says, the implicit faith which a native cherishes in the magical powers of his tribal magician is said to result in cures which exceed anything recorded by the faith-healing disciples of more cultured communities.
If you like eggs, this is some good news. You may not have to shy away from them anymore. A new government study finds they're actually 14% lower in cholesterol.
New study says that eating egg yolks, can raise your risk of heart attacks or stroke almost as much as smoking.
Now, eggs have gotten a bad rap in recent years for being high in cholesterol, but a local study has shown that eating a moderate amount of egg could actually lessen the risk of heart disease, diabetes, and stroke.
Bad news for egg lovers. A new study suggests you may want to pass on that three-egg omelet for breakfast. Researchers from Northwestern Medicine found that adults who ate several eggs per week had significantly higher cholesterol and were more susceptible to cardiovascular disease and death.
Earlier, we talked about some new research from Harvard that found eating up to one egg each day does not increase your risk of cardiovascular disease.
So these beliefs are so firmly held by members of these tribes that the individuals not only have these convictions themselves, but are also being reinforced by everyone else in the tribe as well, because they also believe in the shaman and the powers of the curses and the cures. And that is all tied together with group identity and the need to fit into the group. And I'm sure this has something to do with how, you know, in the Amish, they shun as part of a group punishment tactic where they all turn their backs on someone. And it works. Why does it work? Same thing. It's reminiscent of the Ash conformity experiment, which we talk about on this channel. And I think even recently I talked about it in a video not even that long ago, how it's been shown in psychological studies that people will deny the evidence of their own eyes and minds and basically pretend total lies.
The subject denies the evidence of his own eyes and yields to group influence.
If it will enable them to fit in with the group, because I guess because the comfort found going along with the group outweighs the potential discomfort of having to go against that group. I guess that's why.
But I would like to start with, especially the disease X, it's attracting a lot of attention.
Cannon wraps all this up by discussing whether or not it's really possible to die from fear alone. And he starts getting into the idea of the fight or flight response, which, like I said, is a term he coined. And he talks about how fear, as is well known, is one of the most deeply rooted and dominant of emotions, often only with difficulty can it be eradicated. Associated with it are profound physiological disturbances widespread throughout the organism. There's evidence that some of these disturbances, if they are lasting, can work harmfully. And he goes on to say that more experiments are needed because, I mean, it's only 1942 in this paper, but that studies in cats at that point had shown that when emotional stress of continuous activation of an emotionally stressful response could actually lead to death, or what Cannon referred to at the time as a persistent excessive activity of the sympathico-adrenal system. 60 years later, Dr. Esther Sternberg revisited Cannon's paper in a 2002 article for the American Journal of Public Health. And I just want to read you what they've learned since, because although Cannon could not have known some of the things he was alluding to in his voodoo death paper, much of what he was exploring has since been validated. And she says, in the 60 years since Cannon first published this work, we have simply gained a clearer understanding of the brain regions that become activated when a fearful stimulus is experienced, and a better roadmap of the pathways linking the brain centers involved in receiving sensory signals, which in Cannon's example would have been having a cursed bone pointed at you, for example, to the parts of the brain that process the emotional component of fear in the amygdala. In today's terms, we would call this the vision to fear pathway or the auditory to fear pathway, depending on the sense through which the threat is initially received. We have a deeper understanding of the neurotransmitters and neuropeptides involved in initiating these responses and perpetuating them through learning and memory. We know how such chemical signals are translated into electrical impulses and how quickly or slowly they're conveyed along nerve fibers. And we know that such nerve chemicals and proteins are made by genes within the nucleus of nerve cells that are switched on and off by all sorts of chemical and physical signals. We know that when we learn to fear something, there are permanent changes in the shape and wiring of nerve cells that make it more likely that the next time we experience the fearful stimulus, those same pathways will be switched on all the more rapidly. And then she says, strikingly absent from Cannon's paper, however, is the hormonal stress response, which is the cascade of hormones that gets released from the brain, pituitary, and adrenal glands within minutes of exposure to any sort of stressor. And that's because when the paper was written in 1942, many of those hormones had not been discovered yet. The hormonal stress response was not fully elucidated until the identity of the brain's hypothalamic stress hormone, corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH, was discovered in 1981. Thus, Cannon could not have included in his description of what was going on behind the voodoo death the role of hypothalamic CRH that's released after signals from the amygdala, the brain's fear center, reach the hypothalamus. Nor could he include crosstalk between brainstem adrenaline centers involved in the initiation of sympathetic response that could coordinate with hormones released from the brain's hypothalamic stress center to cause a massive release of adrenaline-like nerve chemicals and stress hormones, which, she says, together might well cause illness, including loss of appetite, weakness, cardiac arrhythmias, and even vascular collapse that can result in death. But she goes on to say, now we have all of this different ways that they've been able to, and she details these very specifically, all these different ways in which they've been able to study this response now and verify these things that happen. Everything from neuroimaging, molecular biology, computational mathematics, bioengineering, endocrinology, cellular immunology, and all of these kinds of things. She says he could not have imagined how such hormones and nerve chemicals could possibly affect cells of the immune system to cause chronic wasting or disease.
You are wondering what today's lesson will be about. Today's lesson in psychology is going to be about emotions. Would you like to know what's in the box? All right. Why don't you come up around the table?
Where'd you go?
You've just experienced emotion. Unreasoning, illogical emotion. Do you think that I'd turn loose a poisonous snake in the classroom? Only association would cause you to feel the emotion of fear at the sight of a harmless snake. Emotion can so work on us that under its stimulus, we may sometimes perform feats of almost superhuman strength. Many experiences condition us emotionally. A bitten child may fear a dog, or a howling dog may make us feel lonely. A train whistle at night, the ticking of an old clock, a word may bring an emotional response.
And I just wanted to share this information with everyone, because this is how curses work. They work in the minds of the so-called cursed, and they work because the person believes so strongly in whatever the thing is that they've been told about how they are cursed. That's how strong belief is. That's how powerful beliefs are. And I've even seen this recently in a documentary series that we watched about the Heaven's Gate cult. I don't know if you guys remember the Heaven's Gate cult. Back in the 90s, they thought they were going to be taken up in a spaceship. They believed that the Hale-Bopp comet was a sign for that, and 39 members committed mass suicide. Well, there were some members that got out before the mass suicide, and they interviewed him. And one of the guys, his voice was kind of weak. And at one point in the documentary, he talks about how the cult leader said something to him about the masculine sound of his voice, because all the members of the group were supposed to be androgynous, and that his voice sounded too masculine. And he, even all these years later, says that he believes that because the leader of his group criticized how his voice sounded, something happened in his mind that made his voice more weak. And that effect is still lasting.
After that, I gradually developed this severe inability to speak like I have still. Always this push-pull, this suppression.
In the cases that are listed in his paper, and I can put a link so you guys can go read it for yourselves. In this paper, there's not evidence of poison. There's not evidence of disease. There's not any evidence of anything in these cases that they've been talking about. It's like a person is totally fine and normal and everything's okay, but then they get told something bad is going to happen to them, and they get told it with enough authority and it gets reinforced by everyone in the tribe around them to the point that they believe it, and the victim's beliefs then become weaponized and cause a cascading electrochemical reaction in the body that ultimately leads to the person's demise. So there are people who will watch this video and they will think this is all ridiculous, but I would counter with, there's a reason why MKUltra, the CIA's unethical mind control experimentation during the Cold War, specifically had projects on developing effective materials to influence the central nervous system or the neurophysiological or pharmacological effects of central nervous system antagonists and synergists, or studies on neuropeptide neurotransmitters. But mixed in with all of these projects, there was also Subproject 121, which was specifically a study on Yoruba witchcraft and specifically involved an African witch doctor. And the study was run out of McGill University in Montreal, Canada. And when you get down into the declassified documents for Subproject 121, and I need to remind you, these documents were referred to by members of the agency at the time as boilerplates, which means what's in these documents does not necessarily represent exactly what they were trying to get at with each project that they were doing, but you typically get somewhat of an idea of what was going on. And in this particular Subproject document, it talks about the usage of, quote, magical words and their defense against them. And then there's a bunch of stuff that's been marked out and classified. And then on the next page, it talks about the treatment of, quote, magical fright, a kind of psychoneurosis in classified. I feel like what they're referring to in these 1960 documents as magical words could easily be on the same par with what we refer to today as trigger words. I mean, it's not that much of a crazy theory to suggest that maybe, just maybe, Rockefeller Foundation connected chairman of the Department of Physiology at Harvard Medical School, Walter Buchanan, and his work on this concept might have influenced their decision to fund an entire sub-project of MKUltra based specifically on African witch doctors. Okay? I just think it's good to remind everybody that's how curses work.
Especially the Disease X, it's
people forget sometimes. Every time period that people have lived in, they always think this is the most forward-thinking and technologically advanced time period. Are we, though? Are we? I'm not so sure after the last 3 years.
A pandemic, which they say will be known as Disease X.
Disease X is a term for a hypothetical illness.
Talking about Disease X.
Disease X.
Disease X.
Disease X, which we're hearing a lot about.
You have no power over me.
And so I just think going forward, knowing this is kind of like demystifying it, isn't it? I mean, that's what I always heard. I heard knowing is half the battle. So anyway, that's all. That's all I wanted to say on that. I love you guys. I'll talk to you soon.